Communicator Stephen Ward.
This sound was recorded on the 28th of January, 1965, Medium Lived Front.
Hello, Rosie.
Hello, Stephen.
How are you?
You're back again.
Yes, of course.
Good.
I always look forward to coming. I may not always be successful, but I invariably do try and make some.
How big is that?
Communication, can't always do it, but I do it when I can.
Yes.
Things are very nicely, thank you.
Oh, good.
I must admit that the atmosphere is a little bit depressing, but I suppose that's something to do with the atmosphere and to do with Churchill's passing. Strange in a way how this can have an effect. We were very conscious of it, you know.
You are up there.
Oh, yes. I should think it must have been absolutely appalling during the war years when thousands of people were being sent over here just out of the blue overnight like that. You know,
yes.
I mean, it's bad enough when you get this sort of mental sort of reaction from people and the press and, well, there's so much going on in regard to Churchill's passing, in London in particular and in England.
Yes.
You know, that there's a sort of, I don't know how to explain it. It's like an atmosphere. One sort of feels it and senses it as one draws near to Earth. Actually, the sooner it stops, the better it'll be for him. I think it may release him even more quickly and more easily. I think that when you get this sort of mass sort of atmosphere of millions of people thinking about one person, that holds them close to Earth. And I should imagine that until this ceases, until after his funeral,
yes,
it will be difficult for him to sort of be released, as it were, from the earth conditions. You know?
He's not conscious of all that yet.
Well, I don't really know. I only assume that if he is awake, that he would obviously be very near, very drawn, and very curious too
as
to what's going on about his body. And I don't know quite what's happening from his point of view, but I only know that I sense it, and goodness knows, if he's awake, he would sense it 1,000 times more, you see.
Yes.
It's bad enough, you know, when just a very ordinary person passes, and it's just the members of their family or intimate friends, the atmosphere then is pretty heavy going, you know, for the person concerned. But when it's a mass thing like this, it's tremendous, you know.
All over the world.
Yes, of course, he was a remarkable old chap, there's no doubt about that.
Yes, I have.
I think he was the right man for the right job at the right time.
Yes.
I couldn't think anyone else could have achieved what he did, and I doubt very much if anyone else would have stuck it out. Actually, when you consider the man's age, I think it's amazing. And I'm not sort of all true blue or anything like that. I don't sort of wave the flag. It's not me. But I think he was a man to be very much admired. I think he was a remarkable man.
Well, he's done his duty marvellously.
Oh, yes. Well, it's all one can hope to do in life is to do one's duty. But he did his duty over and over again. I mean, I think really he is a man to be very much reverenced and revered. I really do. And I'm not the sort of way flag-waving type, you know, the patriotic type. But I really think he deserves it.
The way he was shunned during the war, and very pleasantly he took the lead after that, I think, and without a murmur, I think it was wonderful.
Yes, I do. Anyway, we don't want to talk about this in particular, except and I just thought I'd mention it in passing, because it's strange how, as I draw near to Earth, I sense it very strongly, and I'm sure if he were to be conscious and be drawn near the Earth at this moment, he would be too.
Yes.
I think the sooner the funeral's over, the better. I think that applies to everybody who actually passes.
Yes.
The sooner that the thought force around them is less intense, the better it is. With me, I know from my own experience that it kept me down, held me down to earth, all the talk, newspaper publicity and what have you. it sort of held me down, so goodness knows how much more it would hold a man like that.
Yes, yes.
You see, he was, with all due respect, a materialist. I don't mean in the worst sense,
no.
But, you know, I think he rather revelled in it all, really. I think...
Yes, he
you
did.
You know,
sure.
I mean, he was like an overgrown child in certain respects, with a brilliant brain, of course, but I think he liked all that fuss and all the rest of it.
Mm.
And it'd be nice when he can get clear away from that.
Now, let me know about yourself now.
Oh, me?
You, yes. That is interesting to me.
As a matter of fact, I've been very, very busy. I've been doing some little jobs of my own.
Yes? What are they?
Well, I know it sounds odd, but I've been taken into a vibration or a world or condition of life, is the best way to put it, I suppose.
Yes.
Well, everything seems very odd, and yet at the same time, certainly it's very real for people who live there, but to me it seems odd, because these people seem to be living in a world which is obviously of their own creation, that is, their thoughts are so predominant that that is the condition in which they live, in which they find their own way of life, but it's a peculiar sort of atmosphere, an attitude of mind. It's mm-hmm. one which, well, frankly, gives me the creeps.
Oh, Stephen.
Oh, it's all very interesting. I enjoy it.
But tell me, why should it be giving the creeps? What is the...
Well, they're a race of people, or shall I say, they're not exactly a race of people, they're a sect of people who, I don't quite know what their religion is, it's certainly not Christian, that I do know, but it's some sort of peculiar religious sort of something, and they're obviously, I think they're not Indian or what they are, but what are Parsis?
Oh yes, Parsis.
Well, what exactly are Parsis?
I don't know what to remember. That is a special religion, the Parsis have.
Well, I understand these people are supposed to be Parsis.
Oh yes.
And I don't know, they seem to separate themselves from everything and everybody, and they live in that sort of atmosphere constantly, a mental sort of, I don't know what to call it, resignation or what the devil to call it, but they live in an atmosphere where they seem completely lifeless, is the only word I can...
Lifeless?
Yes.
Oh.
Well, I didn't mean to say that they haven't
any
life.
No,
but what I
mean
is they don't seem to have any sort of interest, only in themselves and their way of life, such as it is, which seems to consist of constant repetition of I suppose their prayers. They live in a sort of community of whitewashed, thatched houses.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what they look like. Anyway, they're
yeah.
sort of, I wouldn't like to call them mud huts, but there is a whiteness about them which suggests, I don't say they don't, that they whitewash them, but all I can say is that they look white to me, with a sort of roof made of some sort of, I don't know if they're reeds or what the divs they are, but anyway, it's like a huge community and they all seem to live there and they seem to have no, I don't know how to put it, but they sort of seem to be completely without initiative. They seem to be, in a sense, lifeless is the word. They don't seem to be able to enter into anything other than just seem to be drifting about, and then they sort of gather and they seem to have some sort of ritual, prayers, I suppose they must be prayers.
Yes.
And they have like little mats on which they sit and kneel and they intone.
Yes, tell me more, Stephen.
Most peculiar. And there seem to be elders or people who seem to be taking command or taking charge. And they seem completely unconscious of my presence or the presence of others that I know that have been with me. It's as if we're in a sort of atmosphere which, I wouldn't say it's dark, it isn't dark, but one can see, but there's a luminosity of a kind, but it's not luminosity from within themselves, it's a luminosity that is there in the atmosphere. But what I can't understand, that these people seem to be completely unaware of anything but themselves and what I suppose is their ritual and their way of life. They live on what appears to be a vast plain. It's a sort of a mountainous area which is in the far distance, which seems to encircle them, and there seems to be a kind of a mist which is pierced by luminosity of light. But it's most strange, most peculiar, because there seems to be a dampness which one senses and, in a sense, feels. And I didn't understand it, quite frankly, although, as I say, I just don't get the hang of this at all. But I understand that they are a community or gathering of people who have certain religious beliefs and ideas, and that they are under some impression, very much like some of the other peoples that I've met, that they have their own figurehead and then have their own way of life, and that they are to be reincarnated, and they're waiting for the day of reincarnation. All this seems so peculiar to me. I don't know whether they are Parsees or what they are.
Yes, must be Parsees by your description and by what you say. They're a sect to themselves.
Well, they seem to have no communication whatsoever.
And they that is true, that is true. Yes, you've got it.
Mind you, I'm told that this is only a small section, although it looks immense to me, because I've been told that the vast majority of these people soon advance and progress, but you do get a certain set number of people who have these sort of beliefs, who so adamant and so clinging are they towards this. I think some of them are very intellectual in their own fashion, at least some of those who are the leaders must be, I think, although not intellectual in the sense that they can withdraw from this way of thinking, but in certain ways they are, I suppose, intellectual. But the vast majority of people that seem to cling to them are very ordinary, very humdrum, and I should imagine very much the peasants who don't seem to have the ability to think for themselves, and in some strange way are held down by these ideas and thoughts, but they seem to have some belief anyway. I'm going to say this, that they are waiting for a resurrection or a reincarnation on earth in a physical sense, and that time to them is non-existent anyway, and that they are very conscious, evidently, most of them, apart from the elders or the advanced souls, as they like to consider themselves, although they're not really in some respects, obviously, but they seem to think that they have got to incarnate again because they've got to experience certain things which are necessary for their spiritual achievement and attainment, and that they've got to be in this state of, I don't know what you'd call it, but it's a sort of limbo land to them,
mm-hmm.
where they're waiting, just waiting, mm-hmm. for a time of incarnation. And evidently, they go down together in large droves, a whole army of them, is any way I can describe it, with their elders at the head. They enter into the earth world in places, I don't know if it is India or Pakistan, but anyway, all I know is it's in the east somewhere, and they inhabit, sometimes possibly from your point of view of time, for weeks and months, inhabit the earth and wait for incarnation to take place. And quite often, of course, it doesn't, invariably doesn't from what I can make out, and they all come back again. And it seems to me that they're all the time drifting from their own sphere or plane of thought back and forth to Earth.
To the Earth?
Yes.
They can't exist on the Earth now, can they?
Oh, no, I don't mean to say they exist.
No.
They're very much like, well, they are, of course, they're like Earthbound spirits in a way.
Yes, yes.
And they seem to have some sort of idea that if they're on Earth at the right psychological moment, they'll be able to inhabit a body, a child's body as it's born, a newborn child,
mm-hmm.
and it seems that they're waiting for rebirth. Quite frankly, I'm so puzzled about this lot that I find it a little bit disturbing. At the same time, although very pathetic, at the same time it has a humorous side.
This is interesting to me because I'm going to question people who have been intimate with Parsis from Bombay. Bombay is the city.
Well, I don't know what it's all about, yes. Except that I know that this is only a minute number in comparison, obviously, to the millions of Parsis who come here and have come here.
Yes.
There's just this remnant, although it's quite considerable, really, but I suppose in comparison to the millions of Parsis who do come here over the years, it's infinitesimal in number, but these are obviously, some of them anyway, are very sort of determined, or shall I say, very devout from the point of view that they have this great, tremendous sort of belief that they have got to be reincarnated.
Mm. Mm.
And they seem to think nothing of the life here, or the condition of life in which they find themselves. They just seem to be waiting. Biding their time and drifting, doing nothing in particular, but constantly sending out thoughts and presumably, I suppose, their prayers, and gathering at intervals. They don't seem to have any form of existence apart from this. And I mean, for instance, over here on different spheres and experiences I've had, millions and untold millions of people have all sorts of interests and all sorts of pleasures of varying kinds and degree according to the individuals concerned. But these people, I can't make head or tail of them because they just don't seem to have any thoughts or ideas of any consequence, merely this sort of biding their time until they're reincarnated, as if they've had no life, as if they deprecate what existence they've had in the past, and the present is merely a lull or an interval in time until such time as they'll be reborn.
Oh,
this peculiar crowd.
I'm so glad you started speaking about that. That is a great point of interest to me, because I was trying to start.
I think some of them, quite frankly, I do think this is possibly very true, that some of them are very, very undeveloped souls. Mm. I think from what I've been able to gather, from what I've been told, what little I've been able to glean, that quite a lot of these evidently were born in dire poverty, barely had an existence at all. I think they were more or less living skeletons when on earth, and they all died comparatively young. They had no possible opportunity or chance to live to any age whatsoever. I think that they were in such a dire condition of existence when on earth, and their lack of education and everything was such that, and their only knowledge, such as it was of their particular faith or religion which they'd been brought up in, which they'd been instilled with from birth. It was inbred, and I think that is something which quite a lot of them can't shake off. And I think that they will not allow others to approach them. They think that they are set apart from the rest, and they won't listen to teachings or advice. In other words, of course, one does feel terribly sorry for them. Of course, one does know that eventually that they will come out of this state. Gradually, some will start and others will follow, but it does seem an appalling thing. But some of them genuinely, sincerely, I think they must all sincerely, genuinely believe that they have got to wait until they find babies, newborn babies, in whose body they can re-enter the earth. It all seems odd to me.
I have met a few Parsis during my lifetime, but they were very affluent people and intelligent.
Well, these certainly
must be on the poor.
They certainly wouldn't suggest so to me, because the very manner in which they exist, they seem perfectly content to live in what I would call rather squalid surroundings. I think that they're clean, that the houses look whitewashed, as anybody can say this. I know it sounds stupid, I have to tell you what I experienced. And I think in their own fashion that they're quite sincere. I mean, they look spotlessly clean in themselves, their robes are clean. I think cleanliness must have been some part of their religion.
Yes, true.
But it's still, nevertheless, to me, a very unpleasant way in which to exist. But there again, you see, I think we've got to get into our heads this. I've discovered this, that what is unpleasant to one isn't unpleasant to another. Everyone has his or her own idea of what for them would be a happy state. And, I mean, for instance, one man in a palace would be happy, another man would be most miserable, out of place.
Yeah.
I mean, that applies to Earth too, we know, but it seems to me that these people look upon this condition of life as a waiting or as...
Yeah. Well, they must have... it's their mental condition now.
Yes,
I think,
well, I think it is obviously that, of course, yeah. Obviously a mental condition, yeah. It must be. But what makes it so ghastly, I think, is that, that somehow because of this state of being that they feel that they are separate, you can't get near them. In fact, they're so separate that they don't even see anybody else.
Oh.
I mean, for instance, you go to some spheres where they have their own particular way of life, and which may be, from some people's point of view, a much lower condition of life than one would want oneself, but at least you are visible to them, they're conscious of your presence. But these people are so bound up with themselves,
yes.
They seem to be completely unconscious of the presence of anyone else.
Aye, they absolutely imprisoned themselves mentally, I expect, and can't see.
You see, the more I see, quite frankly, the more I see of life, whether it's on your side or this, the more sure I am that to have a receptive and an open mind,
yes,
is so vital, because that which is truth today may be truth for the moment, but it's not necessarily truth for the morrow. You see, truth seems to be, I know you can't change truth, but you see, the point is that truth itself can be visualized and experienced on different stratas. And what was a great truth, shall we say, yesterday, is not so great a truth today, because you've gained a greater knowledge and a greater truth,
yes.
And in consequence it's an illusion, you see.
Yes.
I mean, for instance, if you can go back in time, when people believed in certain things on Earth, for instance, and to them that was the truth, as they knew it, according to their light. But man has advanced in certain respects since then, and that seems almost laughable. But it doesn't alter the fact that in that day and age it was the truth. Of course, we know that sometimes people can be very ignorant and accept something as the truth when it has no basis of truth. But there are varying degrees of truth.
Yes, but as man progresses, so truth progresses.
Yes, that's the point.
That's
There's always new truth to grasp,
yes.
New truth to understand,
yes.
New opportunity to be taken, and through the opportunity taken, new realization comes,
yes.
And progress is made. It's when people are content, like these people, so it seems to me to stand still. They still seem to think that if they want to advance, they've got to come back to Earth to gain earthly knowledge and earthly truth, which probably for some reason they were not able to experience when on Earth. I can understand this reincarnation to a point. I think that it is possibly very true in many respects, but in fact I know it must be, but it does seem to me that there are some people who just have this bee in their bonnet, that they must always be returning to Earth. Well, I think that there comes a time when you can take from Earth the life or lives,
everything.
All that you need,
yes.
And there's no need to keep on coming back and back, you see. But anyway, I don't think it's even quite that with these people. This is a religious something, and I suppose in a way it's not unlike the Christian idea, at least the narrow-minded type of Christian, who believe in the resurrection, that they're going to be reborn on Earth, and that's going to be the great new world.
It's the same idea,
yes. Really, fundamentally, which makes one highly suspicious. When the more one goes into this religious not experience, or at least the studies there, the more one knows about it, the more you see the same pattern running through all different religions, and it seems to me that it's something that has been taken from one and added to another, and it's all grown up, and the foundation of truth in the vast majority of it is infinitesimal.
Quite right.
You see, the whole point is that we are all fundamentally, in a sense, well, we are all fundamentally spiritual beings, in that we have our bodies, whether it's in your world or in this world or on this sphere or that sphere, according to the conditions of life in that particular environment in which you find yourself, which serves its purpose for a certain time. On this side we can't judge time the same way, but it does seem to me that we go through all these varying degrees and phases of existence, whether they're material or mental or spiritual, and they all serve their purpose, and we all evolve gradually through them and from them, and we keep going upwards. I use the term upwards, but actually we're going advancing, and then we're gaining greater knowledge, greater experience, and when we've assimilated all that one sphere or plane can give us, then we are reborn, in a sense, into a new plane. It doesn't necessarily mean to say we've forgotten everything that happened in the previous life. That's why in incarnations we can pick up scraps here and there, we can have some remembrance of things past. But it's not only the past, it's the present and the future, and what the future holds and what we may gain from it, and experiences we can learn which will benefit us for further a new life, a new enjoyment and happiness in a different sense or sphere or way. It seems to me that all these different peoples, all these different worlds, all these different evolutions, call them what you will, are all interwoven. I don't think we are really ever completely able to separate ourselves. We are separate individuals, in a sense, that's true, but it seems to me, I mean, even with these people that I've seen recently that still puzzle me a bit, I can see that, after all, there is a link. It may be a very distant one, but it is obviously a link, and when they themselves can become a little more conscious and aware of others, you see, their tragedy is that
yes.
all the time they're thinking of themselves
yes.
as a separate peoples.
Yes.
I think that's one of the things we must, above all, try to overcome, is this feeling, whether it's in your world or whether it's in this, that we are in any shape or form or in any way separate from the rest. There's no such thing. In a sense, there is in your world, there must be, I suppose, different races, but what is important is to realize that all races are really part of each other. There's no real demarcation line or separation, only what man himself creates in ignorance and foolishness.
But I think that is the tragedy of the world.
Of course it is.
Absolutely.
And the barriers that are built up through country and race and pride, and nationality and so on, all these things are what lead to war and unhappiness and strife. If only the world could see itself as a great human race, all fundamentally
well,
the same.
Well, I think they're making strides towards it.
Well, one would like to think so.
Well, with the airplanes going, people are getting to know different cultures.
Yes, it's true enough. It's true enough in a way, but I don't know, it seems to me you take some of these countries that are getting government for the first time, and something they're supposed to have been wanting and striving for years, as soon as they get it they start fighting among themselves, splitting each other's throats, you know.
Patriotism is the fault.
I think patriotism fundamentally is a bad thing. You see, I mean, we've been talking about Churchill. I mean, he was a marvellous man for his job at the time. That we have to get rid of this sort of this patriotism, this country is my country and it's a better country than your country
mm.
and we're a better race than you are, and you know, I mean, all this mentality is
yes.
what leads to wars. It's all so tragic.
It is very, very
good. I admit that you get the same thing in class, dislikes and hatreds and so on. It's all very stupid. I mean, it isn't a matter of whether this person is a better person than the other by class or background or upbringing. It's what's inside them that matters. It's
yes.
their nature and,
yes.
and their reaction to life and to people and how they behave. These are the important things. It's not whether you've been fortunate in a material sense. It's how you are yourself that matters.
Quite right.
Yes, after all, surely the real test of character, the real analysis of the gentleman or lady is not the school you went to or what your bank balance
yes.
is like, it's what you are,
yes.
how you behave. Do you behave like a gentleman should behave? Do you behave like a lady should behave?
Yes.
These are the real tests of character and person, don't you think?
Oh, yes, you're quite right,
Steve. I mean, I met loads of gentlemen. I mean, they were gentlemen when it suited them. And of course I met many gentlemen that really were gentlemen. I mean, the point is that you just can't lay down hard and fast rules about peoples, I suppose. It's not right that one should. And we must look for what is hidden deep down within. Sometimes it's so damn well hidden that we haven't the strength to dig. But the point is that we have to, if we're going to get on with people, we're going to make a headway at all in your life, all this. we've got to see in ourselves something perhaps that we don't see, that may create perhaps certain elements of difficulty for us with other people. We've got to see the good in others and see the worse in ourselves. It's no good just looking for the good in ourselves and plumbing ourselves up and patting ourselves on the back and saying, oh, I did this and I'm this, that and the other. I think we ought to try and see where we go wrong, try and rectify. That's what I've been doing. I mean, I'm no saint, goodness knows, but I do realize only too well my own mistakes and faults, and I've learned from them. I don't, in a sense, regret them, because I realize we learn by these things.
Yes, yes.
But I think we've got to understand others, and we've got to make allowances for others, and we've got to try and help others in the right way, if we can, to eradicate from themselves some of the faults which quite often prevent them from being a happier person, and also at the same time being able to live in a way which, well, they themselves would wish. I mean, so many people don't realize it, but they themselves build the barriers within themselves. They're not even conscious of the fact properly, but sometimes one has to sort of try and point it out to them. Over here it happens, but it's done in a way which no one could feel offended, and sometimes it's pretty hard going, it's true. I mean, I know I've had to learn some lessons, and sometimes they haven't always been easy. Sometimes people have had to show me certain aspects of myself that I never knew really existed. I think this is something that applies to all of us.
Yes.
You've got to be able to take as well as give.
Ah, that's the trouble. You can do it there, perhaps on your side, but it's very, very difficult with many to do it here.
No matter how kindly
you point things out to them, they nearly always take it amiss.
Well, stupid William. But sooner or later one has to realize, I've realized it, and everyone does who comes here, no matter how great they may have been or how humble they may have been, we've all got so much to learn from each other, and I think that we all must realize, I think this is when you realize it more than ever when you come here, how infinitesimal, in a sense, you are.
Yes.
You know, and there's so much the immensity of life and the fullness of life and the opportunity of life here is tremendous, and the vastness of it all, that's the thing that really staggers one. It's the thing that staggered me more than anything, is the vastness of it all. It's beyond description. You can't possibly conceive of it. I can't even now. I mean, I've seen here so many different facets of living and peoples that even if I could explain it to you, it would all still be so small in comparison to the reality of it. The immensity of life, it isn't frightening, it's exciting. At first it may seem a little frightening because it's all so new and so strange, so vast, and one meets all sorts of people from different conditions of life, some highly advanced that you feel, well, they really are gods, and then you realize, they make you realize, not that you do it yourself, they make you realize that they're not gods, they're people like you. But they've learned a little more, and they're more human because of it. They're more humane, they're more understanding, more sympathetic, more tolerant. And that's a glorious thing about it. I mean, the people that I've been speaking about now, in certain respects, they are so narrow and so intolerant and so wrapped up in themselves that they can't see anything, only what they want to see. But the more highly advanced people are so tolerant, so wide in their vision and experience that they are so humble and so lovable and so helpful and so kind, so absolutely fantastic. I mean, I can't begin to describe what it's like to be in a sphere, which I have been taken to, where the whole atmosphere is absolutely illuminated beyond belief. It's as if you are put into a condition of life where everything seems to have a sparkle, and yet in spite of the intensity of its loveliness and its brightness, and it's not the sort of intensity that in any way frightens you or makes you feel, well, I must close my eyes, this is too strong or too powerful. It's something that you can look at and you can take it in within yourself, and as you sort of take it into yourself, it sort of gives you a warmth and a glow that you become almost part of it. It seems as if you're able to take from it all that it can give you, or at least something that it can give you, which helps you to appreciate it all the more and be one with it. And it's as if you are revitalized anew, given a new lease of life, you're given something that is so vitalizing in itself that there's no heaviness at all, there's a lightness and there's an air of freshness and there's a beauty beyond compare, and there's everything that the eye could wish to behold that is glorious, absolutely fantastically so. And you see not only people, but you see all manner of life in all different forms, but it's life in a sort of glorified state. It's as if the birds themselves and the animals themselves have a vitality and a power which they never possessed on earth, to be able almost to commune with you. In fact, in a sense, it's true to say that they can and they do. It isn't that you hear a voice from them,
no.
It's that you're conscious of some beauty from within themselves that's talking to you, or in some way as if you are harmonizing with them and they with you. Of course, this is a state of being which I've only visualized, I've only been allowed to experience for a brief span, because I know I'm not ready for it, and I appreciate the fact that I'm not ready for it, and I would probably, in a sense, if I were to be allowed to stay there, would feel a little uncomfortable, because I would know within myself that I wasn't worthy of it. But the point is that I know that it is yet to come when I am ready for it, but I've been given a vision of it just to give me the incentive to try a little harder than perhaps I have been. You see, that is the joy and the beauty of it. Once you open your mind and you are receptive to this, then of course you make it possible for yourself to have at least a little vision of something that is yet to come. It gives you an extra realization and incentive to work for it, you see.
It's
terribly difficult to explain, but it's something that you feel rather than you can depict or describe or explain.
Okay.
Anyway, a little later on I want to tell you particularly, not so much about the depressing spheres, which I've also seen, but I want to tell you more about the glorious spheres which I have had a vision of.
Oh, yes.
It's been so fragmentary in a sense, but it must be something that
I must
tell you, because it's much more interesting and much more, well, what I want you to know about. I want you to know the better side as well as the senior side.
I like to know both sides, Stephen.
I know you do. That's why I'm telling you about these Parsees or whatever they are.
Yes, yes.
But I want you to know more about what little I can glean myself and what I can experience. I want you to share with me. I don't want to... I just want to try and tell you all I can.
Oh, thank you, Stephen.
Anyway, I must
go. You've got a marvellous vision.
I'll see you again on Monday. All being well, anyway. Anyway, keep your chin up, old dear, and don't worry. You're pretty good hands, you know.
Yes, I know.
Bye-bye.